Hello and welcome to part two of our digestion assessment module on the small intestine. In this section, we're going to look at the small intestine. We'll review what's going on physiologically with the small intestine. We'll review the types of things that can go wrong in the small intestine. And then we'll go through how do you assess the small intestine for function, both from a question and answer and symptom perspective, and also from the variety of lab tests. Before we begin, I want to make sure that you're aware that this information and the information in all of our presentations, as well as the presentations that you do with your own clients, is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's really just education that comes from our experience with other clients and our knowledge and research over the years in practice. And that's how I put these presentations together. So it's really important that it's done in the spirit of education and there's no diagnosis and there's no treatment. And if someone is under the care of a doctor, a licensed doctor of some sort who's prescribed medication, then you need to make sure that you educate that client to talk to their doctor and make sure that the education that you've provided is not incongruent with the kind of care that they're receiving. So let's review the small intestine and its assessment, how we look at the small intestine to see what's going on in there.
And just a review of the small intestine, it's about 18 feet long and 1 inch in diameter. And that's a lot of place where things can happen. The pH is supposed to be 8, which is alkaline, compared to 2 for the stomach. And the duodenum is where your digestion happens, and that's within the first 10 inches. The rest of it is more absorptive surfaces. And then the absorption happens in the jejunum, and it has these villi, which you're seeing here, this big one in the middle. It's an exposed villi. And you see these little bumps at the edge of it. Those are microvilli, tiny little fingers like projections, and that's where the absorption happens. That's where the magic happens. That's where there's increase in the absorptive surface, and that's where a lot of the damage happens. So let's talk about with the small intestine what can go wrong. Leaky gut. You've all heard of leaky gut. Leaky gut is also called intestinal permeability. Those villi, you can see them right here. These are supposed to be intact. You see there's spaces between the cells. Those are tight junctions. And nothing's supposed to be able to pass through the cell. But there's tight junctions between the cells so that food particles can't pass through. Well, when those get damaged, you can end up with leaky gut. You can also end up with malabsorption because a lot of the nutrients require an active transport across the membrane of the intestinal and into the lumen of the bloodstream. And when they do, and you have this inflammation happening, which we'll talk about in a bit how that happens, then you're not going to be able to do that as well, to do the active transport. So the other thing that can go wrong is parasites, other kinds of bugs besides parasites. Parasites, candida, SIBO, that may be a new one for you. Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It's just easier to say SIBO. And that's an overgrowth of bacteria in the gut. And it may be good bacteria. It may be something that normally is good, but it's overgrown and it can cause irritation. And there are tests for that. Of course, celiac, you've heard of. Celiac is gluten intolerance. And it's usually considered gluten intolerance where there is some atrophy already in the gut and there's a genetic predisposition. Lactose intolerance, where you can't break down the milk sugar. And you end up with gas and bloating and those sorts of things. And then Crohn's disease. And Crohn's disease typically happens in either the lower part of the small intestine, the ileum, or the ascending colon as the cecum. Wait, which is ileocecal. Yeah, the ileum or the cecum. But it can happen anywhere in the gut. And Crohn's disease is an ulceration in the lining of the gut, and it can cause bleeding, and it can also cause intense cramping and doubling over. When you hear somebody give you their history and they say they have this double over pain, not that they get cramps and not that they have an irritable bowel, but that there's doubled over pain, you want to make sure that you check them for Crohn's disease. Now, the way to check for Crohn's disease is not one of the tests that we can do. Crohn's disease is typically tested on a colonoscopy by actually going in and looking at that surface. So what are some symptoms of small intestine imbalance that you're going to be looking for? First of all, there's a picture. See that? When as you're going down the small intestine, that's what it looks like. All of those folds are the villi, and the little ones on top, which are microscopic, are on top of that. So it's folded over itself so that you get a huge surface area for your absorption. And again, these are very similar to the pancreas ones because it's similar because it's usually related to low enzymes. So I'll let you just take a look at those. I'll read them really quickly just to review. Roughage in fiber cause constipation. That's unusual, right? If somebody has roughage in fiber, you expect that to bulk up the stool and allow them to have better bowel movements. Indigestion and fullness that lasts 2 to 4 hours. Difficulty losing weight. Pain, tenderness, soreness on the left side under the rib cage again. Bloating an hour or two after eating. Excessive gas, nausea, vomiting. Stool with undigested food and foul smelling. The stool is mucus-like, greasy, or poorly formed. And alternating constipation and diarrhea. So I want to go through the tender spots at the tips of the 8th through 10th ribs and between the 7th and 8th on the left. And hardness or distension around your navel, right in the middle, your umbilicus, 3 inches in all directions. If you ask people, is it really hard in there? Is it distended? That could be a small intestine problem. So this is a list of the tests, and we'll be going through most of these tests, and I give you lots of references. So I'm giving you the broad overview, and I'm going to give you a really good understanding, and then I'm going to walk you through some of the handouts that I've given you that go into more detail if you want to dig in. And then you'll have that for when you're ready to do it. Gluten and casein antibody tests. Now, does everybody have to do those? No. But if they're not willing to just go off of it and test, then I usually will do gluten and casein antibodies. But usually, most people will say, well, if you think it's that's it, I'll just go off of it. But some people are like, no, prove it to me. So we do the test. There's something called the lactose intolerance breath test. That's different than the lactulose. So the lactose intolerance breath test, that's a, again, like the urea test where they breathe into the bag and then it's injected into a syringe sent off to the lab and they'll tell you how well you're tolerating lactose. It's kind of an indirect measure, but it's found to be really accurate. Again, low zinc on the zinc assay test would be found here as well. Hydrogen breath test, that's usually for small intestinal bacteria overgrowth, and it's hydrogen and methane breath test, and we'll go into details on that and where you can order that from if that's something that's going on. Parasite testing is usually done in a stool test, but the parasites affect the small intestine. When you do your blood cell like we did in module 3, the eosinophil count will tend to be high if there's a small intestine, especially if there's a parasite or an allergy, because usually those are main reasons that you're having problems in the small intestine, parasite or allergy. For malabsorption, I'll share with you that something called the urine indican test. There's an organic acids test, which gives you a really big picture of how the pathways for all the nutrients are working in your body. And also there's a handful of those that are important for the small intestine. We'll go through that in much more detail when we do our organic acid module. Well, it's part of one of the modules. We have all the extra tests. Bowel transit time, something they can do at home and test, really important for both small intestine and large intestine. Candida cultures and breath test, and then intestinal permeability. So these are all the different ways that you can test the small intestine to see if it's functioning properly. And that is a close-up of your jejunum. And that's where your leaky gut happens, is right in here. You see these villi. So let's talk leaky gut. Now that you've seen the jejunum, you hear that term all the time, but do you really understand what it is and why it happens? How do you know if somebody has it? Well, constipation or diarrhea. That's a symptom for just about any part of the GI tract. So these are very vague symptoms, right? If somebody has constipation or diarrhea, it's not going to help you rule out or rule in any of the areas here. If they have abdominal pain or bloating, same thing. It's not going to help you to rule in or rule out because it's all over. If they have mucus or blood in stool, it could be leaky gut, but it could also be ulcerative colitis. It's much more likely to be ulcerative colitis or a fissure or a hemorrhoid. So you want to be looking at those things as differentials. Food allergies and sensitivities or food intolerances. You know, a lot of people don't like to use the word allergies, and I'm one of them, although I've gotten in the habit of using it. But they're really, a lot of them are not allergies. A lot of them are not related to antibodies, but they're related to causing inflammation in the body. And when we talk about food allergy tests, we'll share more about that. So food allergies. Next would be ulcerative colitis. So if somebody has ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, or celiac disease, it's a really good likelihood that they have a leaky gut as well, because it's a breakdown in that mucous membrane. Somebody says alcohol makes me sick, or they have a history of antibiotic use, they may have leaky gut. They've used a lot of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. That eats the heck out of the lining of the digestive tract. It just eats away at that beautiful mucous membrane that's supposed to protect us. So some people will take that every day for years because of arthritis symptoms or other pain in their body, not knowing how much damage it's doing to their stomach lining and their intestinal lining and causing leaky gut. So some of the other symptoms you might see with leaky gut. So if you have some of these other symptoms, right, the constipation, diarrhea, etc., and you're not sure what it is, you can look to these others. Well, is the person depressed? Do they have hormone imbalances? Do they complain about brain fog? Are they confused? They have poor memory or mood swings? Are they getting joint pain or swelling? Are they getting chronic or frequent fatigue, sinus or nasal congestion, chronic or frequent inflammation? Skin rashes like hives and eczema and psoriasis and asthma, hay fever, and airborne allergies. Does it mean that somebody with leaky gut has all of these symptoms? No, not at all. But if you're starting to see some digestive symptoms coupled in there with some of the other non-digestive ones, then you're going to be thinking leaky gut is an issue. All right, so causes of leaky gut. Infections, big time. So when you have an infection, it causes inflammation. It causes a breakdown of those junctions. And when we look at the leaky gut testing, you'll see that that's one of the things we're looking for in the testing is antibodies to particular organisms or to the tight junction membrane tissue. They're quite interesting. Alcohol toxins, caffeine, heavy metals, food additives, preservatives, these can all contribute to leaky gut, as can medications, especially NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, aspirin, antibiotics, birth control pills, steroids, and measles vaccine. They can all contribute. Diet and eating under stress are huge contributors. When you're eating under stress, your body can't digest the food. Large particles make their way down to the jejunum. And it irritates it. It causes inflammation there, especially if it's foods that you're sensitive to. Insufficient chewing and poor food combining can all be a problem. Some people are really sensitive to those combinations. Functional assessment for leaky gut. Well, first of all, you want to check their mental and emotional state because when they're under stress, obviously they're going to be more prone to leaky gut. You want to check their chewing. If they're not chewing enough, they're going to get big particles of food and it's going to irritate and aggravate. You want to check their stomach acid. If they're not making enough, you've got a lot of undigested food particles, which irritate the heck out of the jejunum. You want to look at their mucosal lining. Some people have done things to destroy that. Some people have been eating very little B vitamins, for example, and vitamin B1 is super important for a nice, thick, rich mucosal lining, right? Some people are low in zinc. Many people are low in zinc because they're not getting it in their food. Liver and gallbladder function. You can do this. We went over liver and gallbladder function a lot on the blood test, and that's the main ways that you assess the liver and gallbladder. You can do ultrasounds, but that's not something we do. So you may end up sending somebody out for an ultrasound sometime because you think that they may have a gallstone. I've done that. But you're not going to be dealing with that mostly. Pancreatic enzymes. You want to look at how well their pancreatic enzymes are doing. And their gut flora. So all of these things play in. If they have the wrong kind of bugs in their gut, if they don't have enough good gut bugs, and how are they eliminating? You know, you talk to people and they're eliminating once every 2 days or once a day even. It's not enough. Not enough. And things get backed up and can cause irritation. Candida can also cause symptoms outside of the digestive tract. So in addition to bloating and gas, diarrhea, constipation, abdominal pain, burning in the esophagus, itching and burning in the rectum and burping, any of those or none of those, but they may have extra GI symptoms. So headaches, muscle pains, fatigue, allergy symptoms, male and female disorders, PMS, painful menopause, loss of libido, all of these can be related to the toxins produced by these candida. You can have anxiety, depression, ADD, memory problems, and learning disabilities, all related to this little bug. You don't need to have the full background on the system before you know how to assess it. You just need to have a basic understanding. So an overgrowth of the flora in the small intestine can inactivate the pancreatic and brush border enzymes. What does that mean? Well, that nice little villi border, it's called the brush border. Think of it as a shag carpet, the old-fashioned shag carpets. And when you have too much of the flora, it can actually turn off those enzymes. It can turn off those enzymes, and you can get similar problems to when you're not taking in enough enzymes. Overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine can destroy dietary flavonoids. Those are those really strong antioxidants and structural components that help you to reduce inflammation and keep you healthy. This is something interesting. These bacteria, that bacterial overgrowth can actually hydrogenate the polyunsaturated fatty acids in your diet. Isn't that wild? This explains why sometimes when I do a fatty acid test, which I'm going to show you later, when I do this fatty acid test, what I get sometimes is very unusual results where I'm like, why does this person have high levels of trans fats? I know that their diet's pretty good. Well, they may have an overgrowth of small intestinal bacteria. That's interesting, huh? So keep these things in mind. These guys also deconjugate bile salts. We want the bile salts conjugated. We want them put together. We want them to be able to be active. And deconjugating them is deactivating them. And that means that it's going to affect your fat absorption. The overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine consume your vitamin B12. So that would explain why you have a patient who you've put on oral vitamin B12 and you've put them on a vitamin B12 patch and they're not changing the signs. The signs are still there. It may be that they have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. They also produce vitamin B12 antagonists, which will latch on to the B12 receptors on the cells and cause you to it to be as if you had a B12 deficiency. They sneak in there. And finally, they produce chemicals called nitrosamines. And these nitrosamines are in things like bacon and cured meats. Not really good to have your own body making these for you. Especially if you've changed your diet. So if you've got somebody who's really changed their diet and they're doing really well and they're not getting the results, these are some of the hidden things you want to start looking for. Let's talk about some lab testing for the small intestine. There's a lot we can do to assess the small intestine on labs. And let me just preface this by saying, I don't do these all the time. I don't do these on everyone. I don't do a whole bunch of tests on any one person unless there's really good reason. The reason that we spent so much time on the assessments piece from the standpoint of history and examination was because we can get a lot from that. But there are times when we just need more. There are times when it's confusing. There are times when somebody is either in a very severe condition or they've been there for a long time and you just want to get some answers. So it's about weighing it out between their urgency for answers and their budget and how willing they are to do the tests, and then making a decision and then explaining to them what the benefits are for doing the testing when you feel like it's necessary. So there's two tests I want to start talking about, which are both intestinal permeability tests. One is a urine test, and that's one that's put out by Genova Diagnostics. And the other one is the intestinal permeability blood test that Surex Labs works. Obviously, a little bit easier to do a urine test, right? It's a 6-hour urine collection than to do a blood draw where we have to go into the lab to have it done. But there are pros and cons to both of these tests. And I have another slide to go into more detail. This is an overview to show you where we're going. There's stool tests. The stool test tests for normal flora, pathogens, and inflammation. And they're basically 4 labs that I've used. I haven't used other labs for this, but they're probably other labs. These are kind of the gold standards in the functional medicine realm. These are labs that are used very well and very widely by a lot of people who do this work. Genova, Metametrics, Diagnostics, and BioHealth. And there's pros and cons to each of those tests because some of them are less complete than others. And it depends on what you're looking for. And I'll share with you what's in them. Then there's the hydrogen methane breath test that you can use for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and candida. And that one is done by Genova, but there's also some other labs where they'll send you a home kit that you can do at home and then send on in. So you're welcome to look for those, but Genova is one of the ones that I've used most. Gluten test. There's a lot of ways to test for gluten. You can test for stool antibodies, and Entero Lab is my favorite place to do that. I think right now they're the only ones that do it. And then you can do blood antibodies. And there's a complete blood antibody test by Surex. There's also a blood, just going to the doctor and saying, hey, I want to test for gluten sensitivity. They'll run a celiac panel. But it's very limited. And I'm going to show you just what's in the Surex labs, how complete that is compared to the regular blood tests for celiac, which just does transglutaminase antibodies and gliadin. And actually the Surex does about 20 different subfractions of gluten, not just gliadin. Gliadin is the most common one to cause gluten intolerance, but it's not true for everybody. You may have somebody who has others of the subfractions higher, and if you just do a gliadin test, then you miss it. Okay. Same is true for the antibodies in the stool, but they do tend to be a little bit more reliable and sensitive. So let's talk about the intestinal permeability in the urine. This test has been around for a really long time. I remember learning about this test when I first started practicing like 20 years ago, when functional lab tests were just really getting started. So with this one, you need to do an overnight fast, and then you collect a urine sample, enough to put in the little vial. Then they give you a drink. It's a pre-measured challenge drink. And it contains 2 sugars that your body can't metabolize. Lactulose and mannitol. And 2 of these sugars have slightly different molecular sizes, and they're used a little bit differently in the interpretation of the test. You collect your urine after that for 6 hours. The idea is that if you have a leaky gut, you have intestinal permeability, what's going to happen is those lactulose molecules are going to slip through those openings. And the level of lactulose is going to be higher than it was on the pre-sample. So remember, you took a pre-sample, and then we're doing this challenge, and then we're doing a post. And so we're comparing the lactulose level before and after. And if your lactulose level is high, it's indicative of a leaky gut. Mannitol actually is, if that's low, then it's indicative that you're having problems absorbing small molecules. So they're different sizes, like I said. And then if the ratio is high, so lactulose is high and mannitol is low, the higher that ratio, the more indicative it is of leaky gut. So these are interesting tests to do. I haven't done too many of them. I haven't done any recently. There was a while where you couldn't, the lab wasn't allowed to send you lactulose and mannitol for some reason. I guess they got around that because they're doing it again. The C-Rex people, if you read their documentation, are going to say that this is an obsolete test, that the lactulose molecule and the mannitol are both too small to be truly indicative, that you may be getting false positives when really the person doesn't have leaky gut, and that what you really want to do is test for some other antibodies, which we'll share on the next slide. So the jury's out, everybody learns, you read about it, you decide which one is the best test to do. They're both similarly priced. I think the urine one is a little bit cheaper. So this is the report that you get when you do the intestinal permeability. And you'll see in this particular case, the lactulose on the first one is 1.55. So it's out of the range. It's into the red. The mannitol is into the red. The ratio is in the green because they're both high and the ratio between them tends to be okay. So you can't always use the ratio. It's similar to when you're doing adrenal testing, which I talked about in the adrenal module. You can sometimes see that somebody has a perfectly normal total cortisol, but because some of the points are high and some of the points are low, they balance each other out and you don't really see if you just look at the total. Same thing here. If we were to just look at the ratio without looking at the actual levels, we would think that this everything was normal when in fact it's not. The next one I want to talk to you about is the intestinal permeability blood test from C-Rex Labs. And the way this one works is you have to set up an account with the lab and then you have to order the test for your patient. And then they send the kit. It's actually not really a kit, the requisition form to the person. Actually, they do send a kit because that person can either take it to their own doctor to get their lab drawn, or they can go to one of the labs that C-Rex Labs has negotiated with. And what they're measuring are three different antibodies. And the idea is that if these guys are elevated, it means that the gut is leaky. So let me explain to you a little bit about that. Actinomycin is actually an antibody that would get elevated if pieces of the epithelial cell, the lining cell, those cells that have the little villi on them in the small intestine, if they're actually damaged, they're going to release a substance called actinomycin. And if that gets into the bloodstream and circulates around, you're going to create antibodies to it. So that's what this test is measuring. Antibodies to actinomycin, meaning that those cells themselves are damaged. Oculin and zonulin are proteins that are found in the tight junctions. Remember, the tight junctions are the spaces between the cells. So if the oculin and zonulin will get released when there's damage in between the cells and those cells start to widen, the space between the cells starts to widen and widen and widen, okay? And that will allow, once that damage is done, if the space is widened, so say you've got damage to those junctions, but it's still intact, the oculin and zonulin are not going to get in your bloodstream. It's not severe enough to cause any kind of reaction. You're not going to have an antibody reaction. But as the damage keeps happening and the space gets bigger and bigger, the oculin and the zonulin will go up. They'll get into your bloodstream and you'll create antibodies. And that's what the test is measuring. And the last one is lipopolysaccharides. And those are from bacterial endotoxins, mostly from gram-negative bacteria. And what happens is these bacteria are producing these endotoxins, and these endotoxins are aggravating and irritating the lining of the gut so that you get increased permeability. And then the lipopolysaccharides leak into the bloodstream and you mount an immune response against them. So these are the three things that are measured. What they do for the actinomycin, they measure IgA. Antibodies to that, because it tends to be, it's a mucous membrane, it would be formed, and IgA tends to be the antibody that gets formed there. The oculin and zonulin and the lipopolysaccharides, they're measuring IgA, IgG, and IgM. So they're measuring all the different types of antibodies. So when we did this person's test, this is a person who had had symptoms of leaky gut, lots of food allergies, and wanted to know, you know, had she healed it yet? Was her gut healed yet? So we did this test. And what happened, and this was after about a month and a half, maybe 2 months of getting off all her allergens. So you can see that the actinomycin's fine, the oculin, zonulin are fine. So the tight junction area, the cells, the spaces between the cells are not, that's the damage that's happening is not from that. It's from bacteria. So the lipopolysaccharides are what's getting in her, and then she's mounting an immune response. Now, of course, some of these had to break down in order to open up those cells, but the lipopolysaccharide seems to be the most prominent, and it's equivocal. Equivocal means it's borderline. So the range is 0.1 to 1.6, and she's 1.39, so she's close to the edge of the range. So we just followed this up by putting her on some kind of anti-infective protocol, but she really wanted to know what was going on there. We suspected H. pylori, and we had run a GIFX test before this, and it had shown that she had some bacterial overgrowth and some candida overgrowth. So we went and ran this, thinking, wondering if we'd healed it, found that we're still on the borderline there. So what we did was run a stool test, and I'll show you the stool test. I'll actually show you the same person's stool test when we get to talking about that. And we found she did have H. pylori, and she had an overgrowth of bacteria. I think it was an E. coli. And then we worked on that. So it's like layers, layers. This is a person who was able to afford testing. So she just wanted to do any, whatever testing she could, so she could find out what was going on. She'd had very many years of resistant weight loss and fatigue and thyroid problems and skin problems and digestive problems. So she was motivated. And she just had two babies in 3 years. So she was motivated to get healthy. So I want to show you, this is taken directly from the literature that comes with the array. And I've included those in your handouts. So this is basically to show you what's supposed to happen. So you see at the top, you'll see these little green balls that are dietary gluten. And it's in the gut lumen. And you know it's in the gut lumen versus that's the bloodstream because you see the little microvilli on the end of each of these villi. And what's supposed to happen is there's some minor mechanical strain is what they're calling it, and minor chemical strain. The dietary gluten is getting in there. And there may be even some minor infections. I think they're pointing to these little guys here. And that causes minor damage to the fibroblast and endothelial cells, which releases some enzymes to activate that. And what it does, what those enzymes do, they break down and they don't allow cross-linking activity. They reduce the amount of cross-linking. So what's supposed to happen is as this gluten gets into this brush border, it's supposed to be deaminated by transglutaminase enzyme. And it's supposed to be cross-linked by transglutaminase so that it buffers it, gets rid of it, gone. This should be what's happening to control it. But if you have some other problems going on, if you have bacterial overgrowth, you have consistent and chronic exposure to this gluten, your body can't keep up with it. And then it allows these gluten molecules to get into the bloodstream. Okay? Once it's in the bloodstream, your body should be able to handle it. But again, if it's chronic, you're going to have some problems. So I want to show you, this is really key slide here. Remember I mentioned a little bit earlier that you should not be having breakdown of the cell itself, that the space between, the junction between is where the things are supposed to pass through, the small molecules fully digested. Okay, this is like on the right-hand side. And the proteins, that line, that tight junction are oculin and zonulin. What's happening here is that when you've got some antigens, right, some allergy producing foods or bacteria, and they get through the junction because these proteins have broken down. You see they're broken down, the green and the blue and the red and the orange. They're broken down, and now those pieces of those breakdowns are getting into your bloodstream. in addition to the opening, the antigens that are getting in, and that's causing an immune response, not just to the proteins that you've taken in your diet, like gluten or dairy or eggs or whatever else, but also you're producing antibodies to these LPS and oculin molecules. Now, what's happening on the left-hand side is even more. They're getting through the cell. They're damaging the cell itself, the epithelial cell. And that's where the actinomycin actually gets released and put into the bloodstream, right? So it's either paracellular between or through. And that's not supposed to happen. It's supposed to be tight junctions. See, these proteins are supposed to be intact. So these guys can't get through. This is intestinal permeability. And here's another test that's a little bit more problematic. This person, again, the actinomycin's fine, which is good. The oculin zonulin has IgM. It's basically a type of antibody. It's usually a later stage in the healing stages. So we know she's healing here because she has IgM. And the oculin zonulin, so it's the space between the cells that have been damaged. She's also got some lipopolysaccharides, so she does have some bacterial. Again, equivocal on the IgA, which is a mucous membrane protector, and the IgM is definitely out of range, by a lot. So it's saying that she is not in the early stages of this bacterial infection. She's probably in the later stages, and it may be chronic, and it may be there for a long time. If it was earlier, the IgGs would be there. So this is how you interpret the results. So I pretty much interpreted it for you, but the document that I gave you, and this document is called C-Rex Array 2. It's like a 30-page document that you can read and you can study and you can learn as much as you want about it. And you can just kind of review it now, and then as you're getting to the point where you really feel like, ooh, somebody, this person might need this, then you can go back and really study it in terms of the interpretation. So when you have the LPS positive, and it doesn't matter if it's IgA, G, or M, and the oculin and zonulin are negative and the actinomycin are negative, that's suggesting that you have gut flora dysbiosis, right? Because the LPS, lipoprotein, lipopolysaccharide, is actually produced by bacteria or candida or some kind of organisms that's overgrowing. So the clinical approach they're recommending here is just pre and probiotics to refresh the flora. Now, you may also be wanting to do some stronger antimicrobial herbs, but probiotics are mandatory. You're not going to heal this unless you restore the normal flora. The second one, we have the LPS is positive and the oculin zonulin are positive, but the actinomycin are negative. So what that's meaning is that there's a breakdown in the intestinal barrier by bacterial antigens, and they're going through the cells, through what should be the tight junctions between the cells, not through the cell itself. So healing the gut, important, and pre and probiotics are important. And then we have the LPS is negative, so there's probably no bacteria here to speak of. The oculin and zonulin are positive, and the actinomycin is negative, and it means that there's a breakdown in the intestinal barrier, but it's not due to bacterial. It might be through antigens. It might be through gluten intolerance. It might be through some chemicals or drugs or alcohol. And it's reducing the stress, whatever that is. You have to identify what that is and help to heal the gut. And then for the LPS positive and the oculin zonulin negative and the actinomycin positive, it means that the breakdown of the intestinal barrier is, again, by the bacteria because the LPS is positive, but it's going through the cell. It's going through the cell. And as it does that, it breaks down the cell itself, and that's the actinomycin protein that gets into the bloodstream. And then finally, we have everything negative except for the actinomycin. And generally when this happens, it's autoimmune, and it's against the mucosal epithelium and the other cell tissues. So this can be celiac, it could be hepatitis, it could be primary biliary cirrhosis, it could be Crohn's disease. And what's really important here is anti-inflammatory approach. Get the inflammation down. deal with the immune system, get the person on high levels of antioxidants and get them on glutathione or glutathione precursors, things that are going to calm it down and get them off all their allergens, because allergies promote autoimmune. C-Rex, they give you these really nice interpretation guides. Actually, most of these companies do. Nice interpretation guides. So if you're going to start doing these tests, they'd recommend that you just print off that page that has this chart or print off this page. And then keep that in your work area so that if you're analyzing the tests, you can just go through. You don't have to memorize it. After a while, you will. You'll get it, but you don't have to memorize it right up front. You'll have this little chart handy. Let's talk about this methane breath test. It's very simple. You're breathing into your lungs. You're breathing in after you've had this lactulose. So it's lactulose, again, similar to what we had taken orally, and we're doing it again orally, but instead of measuring in the urine what's coming out, we're actually measuring it in the lungs, and it goes over about 2 or 3 hour period. So you drink the challenge drink, and it's not going to be digested by your bacteria, continues through the GI tract. Any undigested molecules are fermented by the bacterial flora. The bacteria then produces hydrogen and methane gases. So this is saying if you've got gut dysbiosis, you're going to have this production of gases. And then they'll get absorbed into the bloodstream and they're going to be carried to the lungs. And then you put this thing to your mouth and blow into it, and it's got an end where you can, by the end, you can stick in a syringe so that everything stays sterile. You don't add air to it, and you suck out the gas, and then you send that off to the lab. You can either do this test by going to a practitioner's office and doing it there, or you could get a home kit and do it that way. And this will, again, this is one that helps us to determine if there's small intestine bacteria overgrowth, SIBO. This is the bacterial overgrowth of the small intestine test. So you could see that at baseline, she had a 14, and then 12 at 20 minutes, and 14 at 40 minutes, and 8 at 60 minutes, and then, woo, at 90 minutes and 2 hours, it shot way up. And that's an indication that she's got a lot of bacterial overgrowth that is basically producing methane, eating her food and producing methane and hydrogen.